Going to call to order the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. Today is Tuesday, January 13th, and I'd like to welcome members to the committee. This is the first committee after lunch, and so hopefully members will be trickling in very soon. But members, just announce that we will be starting on time every day, and we will be getting done on time every day. And so if members are not here, we'll be starting without them. So if you'd like to, you know, participate and fully participate, I encourage members to get here as soon as they can. With that, I'm Deborah Hilstrom. I'm a state representative from Brooklyn Center and Brooklyn Park, and I'm going to ask all the members to introduce themselves, where they're from, and how long they've been on this committee or in the legislature, or maybe something about themselves. And so then we'll go to staff and have everyone introduce themselves. So with that, I'm going to ask Representative Bingham to start.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Carla Bingham. I'm from 57A, which is Cottage Grove, South St. Paul, St. Paul Park, Newport. This is my second term and second time on the committee, and I'm excited about being vice chair this year for this. And did you want to know anything else, Madam Chair?
Your background, maybe?
Oh, first week of February will be 5 years at the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, which I'm very excited about, and focus on property crimes there.
Great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Michael Paymar from District 64B, which is St. Paul, sort of the western neighborhoods of St. Paul, Highland Park, and McAllister Groveland. This is my seventh term in the legislature. I chair the Public Safety Finance Committee and have been on this committee and its various structures since I joined the legislature. When I'm not a legislator, I'm a resource specialist with the Battered Women's Justice Project in Minneapolis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sue Graskowski, I hail from Waubusha. District is 28B, and I represent the northern part of Winona County, the southern parts of both Waubusha and Goodhue County. And this is my first year on the committee, second term in the legislature, and when I'm not here, I'm working in the area of sales and online marketing for a graphics design firm in Winona.
I'm Representative Tony Cornish. Been here for this is my fourth term. I retired game warden and now currently the chief of police of Lake Crystal. And I have three counties: Waseca, Faribault, and Blue Earth County are parts thereof.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tim Kelly. I'm Representative 28A, which consists of Redland, Cannon Falls, Lake City, Goodhue, Waubusha. And other than that, my other job is a financial advisor in Redland. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Rosenthal. I represent District 41B, which is West Bloomington and South Edina. This is my first term. My background is in urban planning and historical preservation, and I'm a currency trader.
And I'm Representative Sheldon Johnson. This is my fifth term, and I think the fourth time on this type of committee. I've been employed in corrections for the last 30-plus years. Currently, I work at the Ramsey County Workhouse as a caseworker and the hearings officer. So pleased to be here, Madam Chair.
I'm Representative Dave Olin. I represent the northwest corner of the state. When I say northwest, there is nothing further north or west in that district state. My background is basically, I was county attorney for 32 years in Pennington County. I am now a retired county attorney because outside the legislature, I'm enjoying myself the few minutes I have of spare time.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I am Corey Pratt, District 26A, comprises of the town of Waseca. This is my first term. Outside of the state legislature, I am a high school political science and economics instructor.
I'm Paul Coles. I represent District 34A, which is central and western Carver County, and I teach at Scott County. I was first elected in 2002 and have been on this committee or some iteration thereof, I think, in each of my four terms.
I'm Sandy Mason, and I represent 38A, which is essentially the western portion of Eagan, and then I've got three precincts in Burnsville. This is my second term in the legislature and my first term on this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Ron Szymanski from District 18A, representing McLeod and a portion of Meeker County in central Minnesota.
All right.
And this is my first endeavor in this committee.
Great. Thank you. Next, I'd like to introduce, or have staff introduce themselves. First, committee administrator.
My name is Peter Stillman, the committee administrator.
Hello. My name is Erin Jupert, and I'm your committee legislative assistant.
And then, staff.
Hi, my name is Becky Perius, and I work for House Research.
And I'm Jeff Ebel, House Research as well. This is my eighth session.
And then partisan. Oh,
partisan.
I missed one. Sorry, I'm partisan. Sorry.
I'm Jim Thurry. I'm part-time with this committee, and I'm with House Research also.
Okay. Great. And then partisan.
I'm partisan Republican Research Consultant.
Your name? And then I have the committee pages. You want to stand up and introduce yourself? Okay, thank you. All right. So I'd like to welcome members. As most of you know, public safety in Minnesota has always been a nonpartisan issue. This is the one area of the budget that and policy where we tend to work hand-in-hand, both Democrats and Republicans. So I'm looking forward to a positive working relationship as we deal with the public safety issues of our state. Unfortunately, our lead Republican is not able to be here today. Representative Drakowski, did you want to have anything to say on behalf of Representative Anderson at all, or no?
Not really, Madam Chair. I'll let him speak before he comes back. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much. Members, there are rules, proposed rules in your packet. You take a look at those. I ask that if there are substantive amendments to the issues that we are going to deal with, that you have them to the committee 24 hours ahead of time. If they're minor amendments or oral amendments, you know, we'll look at those at the discretion of the chair. Otherwise, these are pretty straightforward, easy rules. If anyone has any objections or concerns, if you want to let me know before the next meeting. Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, I have no problem as a member of the minority with the 24-hour rule. We used it a lot when we were in the majority. The only issue is, of course, when we get to the very end of session and we're putting bills together at the last minute, we just need to make sure we have enough advance notice of what's going to be on the agenda and what's going to be discussed. I know that last 2 years, Chair Paymar in the Finance Division was very fair about that, and I trust you will be as well, but I don't have any problem with the 24-hour rule as long as there's enough flexibility for us to actually offer amendments if we have them.
That is correct. I will do my best to give you plenty of notice. Given the fact that we're going to attempt to work in a bipartisan fashion, there'll be no reason to have surprises on either side.
Thank you.
All right. With that, today we're going to be talking about Minnesota prisons population, and we're going to have Susan Allegro.
Yes.
From the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines, start. Okay. Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Hillstrom and members of the committee. I'm Susanna Legro, and I'm the new Executive Director of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. This is my third week on the job. What I'll be doing today is giving you a little bit of an overview of the guidelines, a little bit of history, and also providing some data on sentencing. I'm sure as many of you are aware, during the last few decades, there have been substantial changes in sentencing, which include the introduction of mandatory minimums, truth in sentencing, and in some states, two-strikes legislation. Of course, one of the major policy shifts has been the introduction of sentencing guidelines. In 1978, Minnesota became the first state that created the first Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Minnesota then became the first state in 1980 to adopt the sentencing guidelines system for offenses committed on or after May 1st, 1980. Since then, 20 states in the District of Columbia have some form of sentencing guidelines. In Minnesota, the presumptive or the recommended sentence is determined primarily by the severity of the offense and secondarily by the offender's criminal history score. In most cases, the majority of offenders receive the recommended sentence. The commission has over the years evaluated the guidelines and has made necessary changes. One of the major changes was in recognition of the unique nature of sex offenders. A separate offender grid was adopted for offenses committed on or after August 1, 2007. The guidelines are overseen by an 11-person commission which employs a director and staff. Some of the commission's activities include collecting sentencing information on all felony offenses. Also, we prepare reports on annual sentencing trends and numerous other topics, and we have included a listing of both our annual reports and ad hoc reports, and those are in your packet. We conduct trainings across the state, complete information requests, and we receive these, obviously, from members of the legislature, from practitioners. We also get inquiries from the press. We complete fiscal notes for you on any type of proposed legislation, as well as racial impact analysis. We answer questions on a daily basis from practitioners on how the guidelines should be applied. We collaborate with the Department of Corrections on annual bed projections. And finally, we rank new offenses created by the legislature and also respond to any sentencing issues that arise out of case law. The goals of the sentencing guidelines are to better assure public safety, to promote uniformity in sentencing, and this would mean that offenders who have similar types of crimes and have similar types of criminal history are similarly sentenced, to provide truth in sentencing. And what this means is that the offender actually receives the amount of time pronounced in sentencing. Similar to other states, we do not have any parole board making early release decisions. Offenders will serve at least two-thirds of the pronounced time in the state prison, and then the remainder of time will be spent on supervised release. Last year, the National Center for State Courts did a study which was funded by the Pew Charitable Trust Foundation, which this was the first ever comprehensive and comparative study of states that use sentencing guidelines, and we have included the full report in your packet. And the purpose of the report was basically to determine whether those states that had guidelines, whether the guidelines met the goals of the system. It compared guidelines in three states, Minnesota, Michigan, and Virginia. The conclusion of the study was that Minnesota's guidelines do offer higher predictability due to the compact set of elements used to determine criminal history, as well as comparatively narrow guideline ranges. This was in contrast to the inconsistent pattern that existed in this state prior to implementation as far as to who went to prison and for how long. The report also indicated that guidelines make sentencing more transparent and limited undesirable sentencing disparity by reducing race and economic status factors. Since Minnesota has had the guidelines in effect for the most number of years, other jurisdictions do look to Minnesota for ideas on how their sentencing might improve. We've provided two examples. One, the British Task Force came here last year, and they are going to recommend our sentencing guideline structures as the best solution for Great Britain's prison overcrowding crisis. Additionally, South Korea, which has a sentencing guidelines commission, plans to implement guidelines patterned on R for sex offenses and robbery. I had mentioned previously that we do provide the legislature racial impact analysis on proposed legislation. We were the first state to do this, and since then, Iowa and Connecticut have followed suit. What I've provided to you is what's up here is a chart of the number of offenders that are sentenced for felony convictions starting in 1981 through 2007. And you will note that 2007 was the first year that the number of sentences has decreased since 2000. And this was a 1.7% decline. You will also notice that during 2001 to 2004, we had quite a bit of growth in the number of felon sentences. And this was mainly due to felony DUI and the increase in drug crimes, particularly meth. both trends appear to have leveled off. This next chart illustrates the percent change for all felony convictions, which are in blue, and for each offense type. As you can see, there is a 20% increase in the total number of felonies sentenced in 2002. When looking at each offense type, you can also see that the reason for the increase is mainly due to, as I mentioned, an increase in drug offenses committed that year. 2002 was the first year where there was a large increase in the number of meth cases, which explains why there was a 32% increase in drug offenses that year. Most offense categories in 2007 saw a decline. Both felony DWI and drug offenses decreased by 7%. This was the first decrease for drug offenses since 1999. Property offenses decreased by 4%. Person offenses increased roughly 7%. Most of the growth was due to growth in the offenses of felony domestic assault and domestic assault by strangulation. The next chart shows overall incarceration rates, and by incarceration rates, we are referring to whether the offender is sentenced either to some time in jail or prison. Over the 25 years plus that we've collected this data, the total incarceration rate has grown from 61% in 1981 to over 85% or more since 1991. The highest incarceration rate was experienced in 2005 when 92.2% of offenders received a sentence that included jail or prison. And just to point out, there were a couple of comparisons. In 1978, prior to sentencing guidelines, 35.4% of offenders were sentenced to jail. In 81, when the guidelines went into effect, that number increased to 46.2%. And in 2007, the number was 67.9%. With the prison incarceration rate, prior to guidelines, the rate was 20.4%. That decreased in 81 to 15%, and in 2007, it was 23.3%.
Excuse me, Representative Bingham. I'm sorry, I forgot your name already.
Susanna Allegro.
Ms. Allegro. When you're talking about these, the jail versus prison rates, when you calculate these statistics and you're using the word jail, how broad is that? Is that electronic home monitoring, EHM? Is that workhouse? Is that intense supervised release? I mean, or is that just literally in the jail? I mean, how broad is your definition of?
It's jail time that's pronounced.
Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Jacqueline Krause, and I'm a researcher with the Sentencing Guidelines. Our definition of jail is jail time pronounced as a condition of a state sentence. So if someone is sentenced to probation, any jail time that is pronounced along with that as part of the original sentence.
Okay.
Representative Cole.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just very quickly, is this just, you may have already said this, I apologize, is this just felony, or is this all criminal cases, or is it felony and gross misdemeanor?
The Sentencing Guidelines Commission only deals with felony offenders.
All right, please continue, Ms. Allegro.
One of the things we also have looked at is incarceration rates in comparison to other states. In 2005, the Bureau of Justice Statistics determined that Minnesota's incarceration rate was the second lowest of all states in the nation. And basically what they looked at, they indicated that our incarceration rate was 300 per 100,000 residents. The only state that had a lower incarceration rate was Maine, which was 273. In contrast, the highest state was Louisiana, which was 1,138 persons incarcerated per 100,000 residents. The average rate across the nation is 750 per 100,000 residents. I think we're all aware that the high rate of that incarceration is very expensive. So we occasionally do get questions as far as who is in prison and does everybody in prison need to be there, and what about some low-level offenders. We have provided some information as far as low-level property offenders. And for those of you that may not be familiar with the sentencing guidelines grid, as I indicated earlier, that basically we look at crime severity, and we have levels 1 through 11. And then we also look at criminal history, and we rank them according to points 0 through 6 points is the most. And what we have presented for 2007, there were a total of 4,969 property offenders that were sentenced at severity level 1 through 4. 16.2% of those received a prison sentence, but of those had a criminal history score of 6 points or more, which is the highest criminal history score.
Anyone who if you could please turn it off, that's what's interfering with the sound. Go ahead, Ms. Allegra.
We've also provided some information on criminal history scores for the low-level offenders that were sentenced to prison. And for severity level 1, 60% had a criminal history score of 6 or more. Severity level 2, 67%. Severity level 3, 88.6% had a criminal history score of 4 or more. And severity level 4, had a criminal history, 85.6% had a criminal history score of 4 plus. In cases where the offender was sentenced to prison when it was not recommended under the sentencing guidelines, the overwhelming majority of the offenders, 86.8%, requested execution of the sentence. In 52% of the case, the offender requested execution because they were going to prison on another offense, including a probation violation for a prior offense. We've also included similar information for drug offenders. In 2007, there were 20 low-level drug offenders. In 2007, there were 2,787 offenders that were sentenced to severity level 1 through 4 offenses. Of those, 13.7 received a prison sentence with a criminal history score close to 4. 83.8% received no prison with the criminal history score of 1.39. And again, we've provided the as far as the sentencing, severity level 1, 85.7% had a criminal history score of 6 or more. Severity level 2, 35.3% had a criminal history score of 6 or more. Severity level 3, there were only 4 cases in that category. And severity level 4, 61.5% had a criminal history score of 4 or more. So that concludes our portion of the presentation.
Thank you. Questions from members? All right. Seeing none. Thank you. Next, we have Grant Dewey from the Minnesota Department of Corrections. Please come to the table and state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Grant Dewey. I'm Manager of Research and Evaluation with the Minnesota Department of Corrections. I'd like to thank you for extending the invitation to come before you today to provide an overview of Minnesota's prison population that will hopefully give you a better understanding of the types of individuals who are incarcerated in Minnesota's prison system. In this overview, I'll be focusing on seven main areas. Because it's important to place Minnesota's prison experience within a broader context, I'll be presenting correction statistics that compare Minnesota with the rest of the country, and more specifically with our neighbors to the east, Wisconsin. And then I'll move on to providing a demographic profile of the offenders in the prison population on July 1st of 2008. I'll then talk about the various ways in which offenders get admitted to prison before talking about the various offenses for which offenders are incarcerated in prison. I'll talk briefly about the issue of short-term offenders before moving on to a discussion about offender recidivism, and then I'll conclude by presenting information on prison population projections, what we expect to see happen with the prison population over the next 10 years. In providing an overview of Minnesota's prison population, I think it's important to emphasize that at the outset that there's been substantial growth in Minnesota's prison population since the 1970s. In fact, over the last 25 years, Minnesota's prison population has grown by 322%. That does not make Minnesota unique, however, because state and federal prison populations have increased by approximately 300% over that same 25-year period. What does make Minnesota unique, however, is the low rate at which it incarcerates offenders. And Susanna Allegro touched on this a little bit, but Minnesota has the second lowest incarceration rate, trailing only Maine. As of 2007, data indicate that Minnesota had the second lowest in general fund expenditures on corrections at 2.7%, whereas the national average is 6.8%. Some of that is a consequence of the low rate at which Minnesota incarcerates offenders. One of the main reasons why Minnesota has such a low incarceration rate is because it uses local sanctions more than other states. It relies on prison much less. So the chief outcome of that is that for those offenders who do get incarcerated, they are the most serious offenders. In order for an offender to get admitted to prison, either he has to have committed a very serious criminal offense, or if he committed a lower level offense, then the chances are he has a very lengthy criminal history. And I'll elaborate more on some of these points with the next several slides. This slide compares Minnesota to Wisconsin. Wisconsin provides an interesting comparison, not only because of its close proximity to Minnesota, but in terms of population, it's relatively similar. As of 2007, Wisconsin's population is 5.6 million. Minnesota's 5.2 million. However, when we look at the prison population, we see some notable differences. Wisconsin's prison population is about 2.5 times the size of Minnesota's, whereas one of the other big differences, though, is that the number of offenders who are under community supervision in Minnesota is about 50,000 more than it is in Wisconsin. Once again, that illustrates the fact that Minnesota relies on local sanctions much more than other states, and it relies on prison much less. As a consequence of Wisconsin's greater reliance on prison, its DOC budget is about 2.6 times the size of Minnesota's. In addition, Wisconsin has about 4.5 times the number of adult correctional facilities, whereas Minnesota has 8. And then in terms of per capita correction spending rate rank, Wisconsin was 12th, whereas Minnesota was 38th. And again, Minnesota has the 59th incarceration rate among all 50 states, whereas Wisconsin is 27. again, to illustrate the point that those offenders who do get admitted to prison, either they've committed a very serious offense, or if they've committed a lower level offense, they have to have a very lengthy criminal history. This is borne out by this slide. The horizontal axis represents the severity level of offenses, one being the least severe, 12 being the most severe, And the vertical axis represents the number of criminal convictions prior to getting admitted to prison. And this is for offenders who were incarcerated in Minnesota's prison population on July 1st, 2008. And what we see, if we look at those offenders who are incarcerated with the most serious offense, severity level 12, they had on average a little less than three prior criminal convictions before coming to prison. However, if we look at those offenders who had lower level, who committed offenses that were lower in severity level, we see a lot more criminal convictions before getting admitted to prison. In fact, for those who were incarcerated for offenses with severity levels 1 through 5, we see at least 10 prior criminal convictions before getting admitted to prison.
Could you clarify for the committee the criminal convictions that you counted? What levels did you consider?
Misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, and felony.
So you counted them all?
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dewey, this is a really interesting slide. I'm trying to figure out what to make of it. You said you've got some comparative data. Do you have anything that shows, and I know that not all states have a similar guideline system where they classify various crimes based on level severity like we do here in Minnesota, but I mean, if we've got people incarcerated because of a level 4 severity offense and they've got almost 12 previous convictions, it's clearly evidence of a high recidivism rate, and we've got something. We've got people in the system for a long period of time, and I'm just curious if in some of these other states that incarcerate at a higher level, are we seeing anything differently in terms of recidivism, or is it the same story, just a different way of approaching a similar population?
Mr. Dewey.
Madam Chair and Representative, that's an excellent question, and unfortunately I don't, there's no data to really address that, because in looking at information from other departments of corrections, Wisconsin, for example, they don't publish this information publicly, at least. And unfortunately, there are no states don't report their recidivism rates. There is no national recidivism rate. So, in what is probably the best recidivism or the most extensive recidivism study that's been done to date, the Bureau of Justice Statistics looked at nearly 300,000 offenders who were released from prison in 1994, and they found that nearly two-thirds of those offenders were rearrested for a new offense within 3 years, and about 25% of those offenders were reincarcerated for a new offense. And that matches up fairly well with Minnesota's reincarceration rate. So, in terms of making a comparison with Minnesota and other states, or Minnesota and the rest of the country, it's really difficult. Apart from reincarceration for a new offense, mainly because there's a lack of data to address that.
Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, just a comment, and I don't pretend to know what the answer is, but. You know, clearly, if we have, well, I guess it's a question, at least, is if we were to incarcerate at a higher rate earlier on in the process, either through programming or scaring some of these people straight or whatever the case may be, would we have lower recidivism? I don't know that we would. I'm not suggesting we would, but you know, we clearly have a bunch of people who continue to not be able to find their way out of the criminal justice system, and you know, at some point in time, society gets fed up with them and says, all right, you're going to prison. I'm not pretending to offer any kind of solution here, but it raises an interesting question. I'd be interested if there is additional information that you can provide me. I'd love to see it.
Mr. Dewey, continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To elaborate a little further on the criminal histories of those who were incarcerated in Minnesota's prison population on July 1st, we see that 90% of those who were incarcerated had at least one criminal conviction before getting admitted to prison. And in the graph to the right, it provides percentages across offense types for those who had at least one prior criminal conviction before getting admitted to prison. For example, we see that of the sex offenders incarcerated, 84% had at least one prior criminal conviction. But that also means that 16% did not have a prior criminal conviction before getting admitted. Whereas when we start looking at some of the lower level offenses, like property offenses, we see that 97% had at least one prior criminal conviction before getting admitted. Some of you might be wondering, well, what about the 10% who did not have a criminal conviction before getting admitted? We see that the average offense severity level for that 10% was 9.5, whereas the overall average for the prison population is 7.1. So they've committed more serious offenses, and in particular, nearly 80% are incarcerated for committing a violent crime, because 51% were person offenders, and most of those person offenders are murderers, and sex offenders accounted for 28%. Those were the top two offense types. This slide provides a demographic profile of the inmate population on July 1st, 2008. Of the 9,224 who were incarcerated, nearly 94% were male, the remaining 6% female. 36 was the average age, while in terms of race, whites accounted for 56%, African American 34%, American Indian 8%, while those falling into the Asian or other category was 2%. The aging of the prison population is an issue that has received attention lately, and we see that offenders ages 50 or older, that there were 971 of those, which accounted for nearly 11% of the prison population. In contrast,
Representative Johnson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question on that age. Seems older than I would have expected on the average age. Is that the mean or the median age?
Mr. Dewey.
Madam Chair and Representative, that is the mean age.
And do you have...
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have the median age, too?
Mr. Dewey.
Madam Chair and Representative, I could provide the median age at a later time, if you wish.
That would be fine. Representative Durkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dewey, do you have any data on country of origin, citizenship status, that type of thing?
Mr. Dewey.
Madam Chair and Representative, we do have that information, although it's not included within this presentation. Again, I could provide that information at a later time, if you wish.
Representative Durkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. Thank you, sir.
All right. Mr. Dewey, go ahead. Representative Mason.
Madam Chair, Mr. Dewey, just one question. For these that are over age 50, do you have any idea about when these people were? Is it their age 50 and over because their sentences are so long, or are we actually sentencing people that are, say, 45 and above?
Mr. Dewey.
Madam Chair and Representative, part of the aging of the prison population has to do with the fact that the length of prison sentences have increased. Specifically, over the last 20 years, the legislature has passed more than 100 major criminal sentencing enhancements. So we have more offenders coming into prison for longer periods of time, which does increase the age of the prison population. But then it's important to emphasize, though, that we also have, or at least prior to 2002, we did not have offenders coming into the system for felony DWI offenses. And our data indicate that the average age of felony DWI offenders is about 39 years old, which is pretty old for the prison population. So a lot of it has to do with longer sentences, staying for longer periods of time, because the average age of our prison population, it was 28 back in 1983, whereas it's 36 now.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Dewey,
go ahead. Thank you, Madam Chair. In contrast to the aging of the prison population, we see that there are only 13 offenders in the adult system who are under the age of 18 on July 1st. And then for lifers, we see that there are 519 in the prison population on July 1st, which made up 6% of the prison population.
Mr. Dewey, could you give us a definition of a lifer?
Madam Chair and representatives, a lifer is an offender who is sentenced to, well, we have various lifer sentences. There's the standard 30-year lifer who's up for parole, I believe, after 30 years. Then we also have life without parole. And then we have some offenders who were given a life sentence before 1989. They're 17-year lifers.
So when you count this 519, which definition of life did you use?
All three of those.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Dewey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are three main types of prison admissions: new court commitments, probation violators, and release violators. With new court commitments, those include offenders who, after getting convicted for a felony level offense, they're sentenced directly to prison. These offenders who were admitted as new court commitments made up 71% of the prison population on July 1st. And the average length of stay for these offenders, based on DOC data from 2003 to 2008, indicates that they're in prison for about 39 months. The second type of prison admission are probation violators, which accounted for 16% of the prison population on July 1st. These are offenders who, after getting convicted of a felony level offense, they get sentenced directly. Instead of getting sentenced to prison, they receive a stay of execution and are sentenced to probation, which may include some time in jail. These offenders, their average length of stay is 16 months, which is nearly 2 years less than it is for new commitments. And the third and final type of prison admission are release violators, which accounted for 13% of the July 1st prison population. These are offenders who are initially admitted to prison either as a new court commitment or as a probation violator, and then after being incarcerated for the initial two-thirds of their sentence, they're then released to the community under supervision, and while under supervision, they violate the conditions of supervised release, have their supervised release revoked, and then come back to prison. The average length of stay for these offenders is about 5 months. So as you can see, that due to the longer length of stay, trends in new commitment admissions have a disproportionate impact on prison population levels, whereas trends in release violator admissions, because they have the shortest length of stay, tend to have the least impact. Here we take a more detailed look at the three admission types. We're looking at the distribution of offense types for these three admission types. For example, on July 1st, there were 6,539 new commits in prison. 36% of these were person offenders, 14% sex offenders, 21% were in for drug offense, 11% in for a property offense, 5% DWI, 6% weapons, and then 7% of offenders fell into the miscellaneous other category. And then when we look at probation violators, we see some of the top offense types: person at 22%, drugs at 21%, property and DWI at 16% apiece. And then when we look at release violators, we see that 40% of these offenders are sex offenders, 21% person, drugs at 16%, property at 10%. There are a few things that jump out from this table. The first is the fact that sex offenders account for 40% of our release violators. That's due to the fact that not only are they revoked more often than the other offense types, but when they do come back as a release violator, they have longer lengths of stay. As you recall, 5 months is the average for all release violators. For sex offenders, it's 8 months. Another thing that jumps out is the extent to which DWI offenders enter prison as probation violators. You see that for DWI offenders, they account for only 5% of new commits, 7% of release violators, but they account for 16% of probation violators.
Do you know how many of these probation violators came back because of a technical violation versus came back because they committed a new crime?
Madam Chair and members, unfortunately, we do not, or the Department of Corrections does not receive data on reasons why an offender has his or her probation revoked. Probation is delivered three different ways, or there are three different delivery systems for probation in Minnesota, and unfortunately, there's not a consolidated source of data that indicates why an offender had his or her probation revoked.
Representative Bingham. Madam Chair, and this isn't the question I wanted to ask, but why? Why is there not a consolidated area to have that information? Mr. Dewey.
Madam Chair and members, unfortunately, I've only been with the Department of Corrections for almost 5 years, so
okay.
I don't know the full history behind why there's not a consolidated source of data for that.
Okay, Matt Bingham. It just seems like that would be something we would want to take a look at. But the question that I have, are you on this slide here, are you talking about with the new commits, Mr. Dewey? We'll just use the persons one. So if you have 36% of the new commits are of person, are you saying of the new commits, 21% of those new violate? I guess I'm wondering if this is just across the board or is this just of new commits? Mr. Dewey.
Madam Chair and Representative, all that means is that of the release violators in the prison population, there are 1,208 on July 1st, 21% were person offenders. That doesn't mean that only 21% of person offenders have their supervised release revoked.
Okay. I was confused. Sorry. Mr. Drakowski. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dewey, could you outline just for us what are the type of violations generally you see under the persons category and the other category?
Mr. Dewey.
Madam Chair and Representative, are you referring to supervised release violations or violations of supervised release?
Representative Drakowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, Mr. Dewey, just generally, what fits into what qualifies as a person crime in your categorization in the way you categorize things, and same thing with the other category.
Mr. Dewey.
Madam Chair and members, actually the next 7 slides will provide a profile of each of the 7 offense types where I'll kind of elaborate in more detail. I can answer that now if you wish, or I can address it as I go on.
That's fine. You can just do it as you want. Did you have a question, Representative Cole?
No.
Okay. All right. Okay. Mr. Dewey.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. As I indicated, these next 7 slides will provide a more detailed portrait of the offenders in our prison population by the type of offense for which they're incarcerated. And I'll begin with our most common offense type, which is person. On July 1st of 2008, there were 2,955 person offenders in the prison population, which accounted for 32% of all offenders. And the most common offenses falling within this person category are murder, assault, robbery, and kidnapping. If you recall that the average severity level of the prison population in general is 7.1, while the average number of prior criminal convictions is 7.2. So with person offenders, we see that although they have fewer prior criminal convictions on average at 5.8, they have committed offenses that are more severe because the average severity level, 8.4, is greater than 7.1. In the graph to the right, this shows the types of prior criminal convictions that these person offenders committed. So what this means, for instance, is that of the 2,955 person offenders incarcerated, there were 51% who had a conviction for another person offense prior to coming to prison. Similarly, 51% had a prior conviction for a property offense before coming to prison, and we see that other is the most common category here at 62%, meaning that 62% of the person offenders had a criminal conviction falling in the other category. Some of the more common offenses in this other category are stalking, violating a protection order, or fleeing law enforcement.
Mr. Dewey, could you clarify, if someone had more than one crime prior to this admission, would they be in each one of these categories, so one person could be in all of these categories? Mr. Dewey?
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct.
Thank you. Continue, Mr. Dewey.
And Madam Chair, I think your question kind of illustrates the fact that I think that sometimes when we think about offenders in prison, we tend to categorize them as sex offenders, person offenders, drug offenders, which is sort of a misconception. I realize I'm kind of contributing to the misconception by talking about them in terms of offense types, but they really don't specialize. And I think that's what you'll see over the next several slides is that sex offenders just don't commit sex offenses. Property offenders just don't commit property offenses. Instead, there's a fairly wide variety of offenses that they've committed before coming to prison. The second most common offense type is drugs. On July 1st, there were 1,841 drug offenders in prison, which accounted for 20% of our population. The big three, meth, crack, and cocaine, accounted for 92% of the drug offenders. In addition, 70% of the drug offenders were incarcerated for either a first or second degree drug offense, although it is worth pointing out that a number of drug offenses are plea bargained down, so those in the third to fifth degree range, some of those offenders may have committed more serious drug offenses. The average severity level for the 1,841 offenders was 7.3, while the average number of prior convictions was 7.3. In the graph to the right, we see that again, the other category has the highest percentage. 73% of the drug offenders had a prior criminal conviction for an offense falling into this other category. The other thing that I'd like to point out is that 58% of the drug offenders had a prior criminal conviction for a drug offense, which is the highest among the seven offense types that I'll be talking about. So even though offenders don't specialize, they do have a tendency to commit or to have a proclivity for committing similar types of offenses in the past. The third most common type of offense are sex crimes. On July 1st of 2008, there were 1,628 sex offenders in the prison population, which accounted for 18%. Of those 1,628, 89% victimized someone they knew. Of that 89%, 33% victimized a family member, while the remaining 56% victimized an acquaintance or someone else they knew. Meanwhile, 11% victimized someone they did not know. The average number of prior criminal convictions for sex offenders, 4.1. That is the lowest average among the seven offense types. Once again, the other category accounts for the most prior criminal convictions, while when we look at prior sex crime convictions, we see that 23% had a conviction for a sex offense before coming to prison. What that also means, though, is that 77% that this was their first sex crime conviction. The fourth most common offense type, property, which accounted for 12% of the prison population. Property offenses include burglary, theft, forgery, arson. The average severity level for these offenders was a little lower, 4.9. However, property offenders generally have more extensive criminal history. The average number of prior criminal convictions was 11.5. Once again, the tendency to commit similar types of crimes, we see that 83% had a prior criminal conviction for a property offense before coming to prison, while 82% had a prior criminal conviction for offenses falling into the other category. Our fifth most common offense type, felony DWI. On July 1st, there were 663 offenders, which accounted for 7% of our prison population. When the felony DWI law was enacted on August 1st, 2002, it was given its own severity level of 7, so all 663 committed an offense with a severity level of 7. The average number of prior criminal convictions for felony DWI offenders is 11.8, which is the highest among the 7 offense types. Now, part of that is due to the statutory requirement that in order to get charged for a felony DWI, an offender has to have at least 3 DWI convictions within the last 10 years or a previous felony DWI conviction. But even when you subtract out prior DWI convictions, DWI offenders have on average 7.6 prior criminal convictions. In fact, when you look at the graph on the right, we see that 57% of the DWI offenders had a prior criminal conviction for a person offense. 61% had a prior criminal conviction for a property offense. And of course, all 100% had a prior conviction for DWI. And the 84% in the other category is the highest among the 7 offense types. Our sixth offense type is weapons. On July 1st, there were 456 offenders in for weapons offense, or 5% of the prison population. The two main types of offenses in this category are weapon possession by a felon and drive-by shooting. The average severity level for these offenders is 6.1, but the average number of prior convictions was 7.3. And what we see here in the graph to the right, 62% of the weapons, 62% of the weapons offenders had a prior criminal conviction for a person offense, which was highest among the 7 offense types, while the other category, or weapons offenders, at least 75% had a prior criminal conviction for an offense falling into the other category. The seventh and final offense type is the other category. On July 1st, there were 580 offenders in the prison population, or 6%. Offenses falling into the other category are failure to register as a predatory offender, stalking, or driving under the influence, leading to a traffic fatality. The average severity level for these offenses is a little lower at 4.5. However, they do generally have more extensive criminal histories. The average number of prior criminal convictions is 9.1. One thing that's worth pointing out in the graph to the right is that of those who are incarcerated for an offense falling into the other category, 62% have a prior conviction for a person offense, while 26% have a conviction for a sex offense. So the offenders falling into this category are more likely than offenders for the other offense types to have a prior violent crime conviction. Prior to talking about offender recidivism, I'd like to briefly discuss the issue of short-term offenders. So far, I've talked about offenders in the prison population as of July 1st, 2008, that there were 9,224. However, there were also 326 offenders who were committed to the commissioner, but who were not incarcerated in a state correctional facility. Rather, they were incarcerated in local facilities. And that's the result of the short-term offender law that was enacted on July 1st, 2003, which requires offenders sentenced to prison who have a term of imprisonment of 180 days or less at the time of sentencing to serve their time in a local facility. DOC policy requires sex offender STOs to serve time in prison rather than locally. In the pie chart on the right, it provides the distribution of offense types among the 326 STOs who were incarcerated on July 1st. You see that 35% were property offenders, 32% were drug offenders, person offenders at 21%. Those falling into the other category at 10% with weapons and DWI with 1% apiece. One of the things that jumps out with the STOs is that 81% were admitted as a probation violator, whereas 19% are new commitments.
So we don't know whether these are technical violators either, correct, Mr. Dewey?
Madam Chair, that is correct. We do not know whether that 81%, whether they had their probation revoked for a technical violation or whether they had it revoked for committing a new criminal offense.
Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the average length of stay for those STOs following their commitment to the commissioner was 130 days. For better or worse, recidivism is the gold standard by which we measure the effectiveness of correctional programming. The DOC typically measures recidivism as either a felony reconviction or as a reincarceration for a new offense. 3 years is the standard follow-up period for tracking recidivism. It's worth pointing out, though, that one of the best predictors of future criminal offending is prior criminal record. That is the more extensive the criminal history, the greater the risk of recidivism, which is illustrated in this next slide, which breaks out recidivism rates by offense type for offenders who were released from Minnesota prisons in 2003 and 2004. In the upper left-hand corner of the graph, you see that the overall felony reconviction rate over the three-year follow-up period is 36%. So that means for those offenders who were released in 2003 and 2004, 36% were reconvicted for a felony offense within 3 years. The overall reincarceration rate was 25%. That means that of those offenders released in 03 and 04, 25% returned to prison for committing a new felony level offense within 3 years. But when we look across offense types, we see several important things. The first is, when we look at sex offenders, we see that their felony reconviction rate is 16% over 3 years, whereas their reincarceration rate is 9%. They have the lowest recidivism rates among the seven offense types, but that kind of makes sense, though, when you consider that the slide that I showed earlier, that sex offenders generally have less extensive criminal histories than the other types of offenders who get admitted to prison. And prior criminal history is a salient predictor of future criminal offending. And I'd like to direct your attention over to the far right, where we see the highest recidivism rates for DWI offenders, the offenders falling into the other offense type, as well as property offenders. Those three categories of offenders have the three highest recidivism rates.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dewey, in relation to this, I was curious, on the DWI, you're stating that this occurs three previous DWIs. So what are the extenuating circumstances that allows us to go to an average of 4.2, you know, for incarceration?
Mr. Dewey.
Madam Chair and Representative, I believe you're referring to the 4.2 prior DWI convictions.
I'm sure, correct.
Mr. Dewey.
And Madam Chair and Representative, well, in order to be charged with the felony DWI, at least three of those would need to be one of the requisite priors that within that 10-year period, that 10-year look-back period. So they could, it's possible, for example, that they had three or possibly even four or prior DWI convictions, and it wasn't until they had their fourth or fifth that they were actually charged with the felony DWI offense.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Dewey, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I was indicating previously, that we see the highest recidivism rates for the offenders who actually were admitted to prison for offenses that were lower in severity, but they were admitted to prison because they had more extensive criminal histories. Which what's perhaps the irony here is that often we think of those who commit violent crimes as being significant public safety risks, and they are. But it's also important to emphasize that even those who commit lower level offenses, that because they have that significant criminal history, which is what they need in order to get into prison, they are greater risks when it comes to reoffending. And our recidivism data, as shown here, bear that out. And lastly, I'd like to conclude with a discussion of prison population projections. As Suzanne Allegro mentioned, the DOC and the Sentencing Guidelines Commission has collaborated to produce prison population projections at least since the early 1980s. And the prison population forecast, which covers a 10-year forecast period, is based on current trends, laws, and practices. Annual forecasts over the last 3 years have been very accurate, as the average monthly error rate has been 0.4%, which works out to the forecast being off from the actual prison population by about 45 offenders per month. This slide indicates what our prison population projections will be over the next 10 years. But it also shows what our actual prison population has been since 2000. The blue bars indicate what the actual prison population was as of July 1st from 2000 through 2008, whereas the red bars indicate what we project the prison population to be on July 1st from 2009 through 2018. As you can see in the upper left-hand corner, that the prison population has increased by nearly 3,000 offenders since the beginning part of this decade, which works out to an average annual increase of about 369 offenders. But, you know, if you look at the blue bars, you see that from 2000 through about 2006, there's a consistent sharp increase in the prison population. Some of that, well, actually, quite a bit of that was driven by the meth boom, but felony DWI offenders that law was created in 2002, and as you saw from the felony DWI slide, there were 663 felony DWI offenders in prison as of July 1st, 2008. So from that 2002 to 2005 period, where we saw a lot of growth in the prison population, DWI offenders and meth offenders accounted for two-thirds of that growth. But over the last few years, the prison population, although it's still growing, it's growing at a much slower rate. And our projections over the next 10-year period reflect the fact that we have seen a slowdown in the growth in the prison population, because when you look at our projections over the next 10 years, we anticipate that it will increase by a little more than 2,000 offenders, which works out to an increase of about 206 offenders per year.
Representative Cole.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Dewey, at what point does the Department of Corrections get absolute maximum capacity in terms of bed space or the ability to house offenders. I assume at some point along this this line is a need for additional beds somewhere, whether it's another state facility or leasing beds or whatever the case may be.
State your name for the record and then go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, my name is David Crisp. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Facilities Division of the Department of Corrections. Based with a couple of assumptions, one is that we are holding 182 release violators in various county jails around the state, and the second assumption being that there are private beds available to rent at the Prairie Correctional Facility in Appleton, Minnesota. We do not anticipate bonding for additional male beds until the bonding session of 2014, and we do not anticipate bonding for additional female beds well past the end of this chart.
Thank you.
Representative Mason.
I have two questions. One is, when you're talking about the slowing down of your population, does that have anything to do with the graying population in general?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the word.
Overall, we are dealing with an aging population, and typically it used to be that it was the younger people that we were incarcerating. So our whole population is growing grayer. Could that be one of the reasons that you're not seeing much of an increase or forecasting an increase?
Mr. Dewey.
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't know if that factors in much to the slowing down of the growth in the prison population. I think what I can say is that the meth boom is over, and it has been for several years. That is a large contributor to the slowdown in the prison population. Going back again to our felony DWI population, we saw pretty significant growth in the number of felony DWI offenders from 2002, the first year it was passed, up through about 2005 or 2006. That population is still growing, but it's kind of plateaued a little bit. So really the two main offense types that accounted for such a large portion of our growth in the earlier half of this decade have really slowed down. In the case of felony DWI, it's plateaued, and in the case of meth offenders, we actually have seen a decrease of about 200 offenders in our meth population, because at the beginning of this decade, we had less than a few hundred meth offenders in our prison population, but by 2006, we had 1,100. That is a staggering increase, and just from one specific type of drug offense. But since it reached a high of 1,138 in 2006, it's dropped by nearly 200 offenders since then. And it, those types of things do have an impact on the size of the prison population.
Representative Mason.
I have one more question regarding, it used to be my impression that a lot of the people that were being incarcerated, drugs were obviously a main part, regardless of the first offense. How much treatment are people now getting in our institution for drugs before they're released?
Mr. Dewitt, I'm not sure the proper person to answer that question, but if you can't, maybe we could get something from the department to Representative Mason. Mr. Dewitt.
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't know if I am the proper person to address that. And I think what I would be able to provide you would be what I remember off the top of my head, and I don't know if that would be accurate, and I would prefer to give you accurate information, so if that's okay with you, then
that's fine.
Okay.
All right. Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dewey, I have three questions. The first one is this data on priors. I assume that doesn't include juveniles, and so do you have that data also for juvenile crimes? Second question, is there any data by state of origin of the person, especially for, I'm talking about mostly on violent crimes? And the third is, with the lifers, what crimes are they in for percentage-wise?
Mr. Dewey.
Madam Chair and Representative, regarding the juvenile data, if I understand your question correctly, all of the prior criminal
history data are for offenses committed as adults, or unless they were committed as a juvenile and then were certified as adults. To answer your second question, we know where offenders were born. I don't know if that gets to your question on state of origin or whether you're talking about where the prior criminal offense was committed.
Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, on the first question, I don't think you got quite what I was looking for. I was looking for, do we have data on what juvenile offenses they have had? In your data here on priors, I believe that's data as to once they're an adult. Do we have it also on juvenile so that you could have these charts on juvenile? Second question was state of origin. I was thinking more of if they've only been here from another state, like a year or a couple years or a few years, is there any data on that, especially for violent criminals?
Mr. Dewey.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative, for that clarification. Regarding the juvenile data, no. Unfortunately, we do not have that information. Regarding your second question, I think you're trying to get at the transiency of those who are in the prison population, whether they've been residents of Minnesota for quite a while or whether they've moved recently. Information like that can sometimes be gleaned from what are called pre-sentence investigation reports. Unfortunately, in order to get that data, we would have to go through that manually, which is a very time-intensive process. It's not available electronically, like most of the information in the Department of Corrections database. And then to answer your third question on lifers, the vast majority of the offenders who are in for a life sentence, it's for first-degree murder.
Mr. Dewey, go ahead with the last slide.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
1 second, Representative Drifthouse, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, Mr. Dewey, what are the predominant variables that you include in the projections over the next decade? And I realize the one-third and half that you've got in those categories on my slide there is the last one on this page. But of those variables, which are really the predominant ones that are contributing to what you see as an increase in those two categories?
Mr. Dewey.
Madam Chair and Representative, there's nothing from our recent forecast that suggests that there's one particular offense type that's going to have a disproportionate impact on the prison population. A few years ago, when we were in the throes of the meth boom, our forecast would indicate that we were going to have a huge meth offender population. But fortunately, that has subsided. And really, our forecast is based on what's happening currently. And we can only base it off current trends, laws, and practices. And currently, there's no particular offense type that we think will have a huge impact on the prison population. Now, when we develop our prison population forecast, we look at offenders in our stock population, like a snapshot as of July 1st, 2008, and then we also look at admissions data. What are the types of offenders who are getting admitted into prison? And we typically use 12 months worth of admission data, and then we combine that with our stock population data to come up with an estimate of what our prison population will be over, not only over the next fiscal year, but over the next 10 years. Now, suffice it to say that the farther we go out in the forecast period, the less certain we are of the estimate. And some of that has to do with, well, a large part of that has to do with trying to anticipate
what the trends in prison admissions will be, because that is easily the most difficult or challenging part about trying to forecast the prison population is trying to figure out whether our new commitments are going to increase by 1 percentage point or 2 percentage points 3 or 4 or 5 years down the road, and that's difficult to anticipate. So our forecasts have been, at least over the short term, have been very accurate. As I indicated a few slides back, our forecasts have only been off by about 0.4% each month. But again, once we get farther out into the forecast period, that the certainty of the forecast is less.
Thanks.
Mr. Dewey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We anticipate that much of the growth over the next 10 years, that males will account for that, while our female offender population will account for a very modest portion of that. Due to an increase that we saw in new commitment admissions during fiscal year 2008, we anticipate that there will be a slight bump in the prison population over the next year or two. And then with regard to offense types, we anticipate that drug offenders will account for much of the short-term growth, but only about one-third of the long-term growth, whereas sex offenders and other person offenders, we expect that they will account for about half of the growth over the 10-year period. And that concludes my presentation. Again, I want to thank you for extending the invitation to come and talk to you today and give you an overview of Minnesota's prison population.
Questions from members? All right, seeing none, just a few announcements, members. Our next hearing will be January 15th. It will be immediately following the Governor's State of the State address. We will be talking about getting a criminal law overview and having the public defenders make a presentation. And then our next three hearings will be joint hearings. January 20th, it will be joint with the Public Safety Finance Committee, and that will be at the Public Safety Finance Committee's time slot. So January 20th will be at 8:30 a.m. January 22nd will also be joint with the Senate Judiciary Committee. That will be during our time slot. We will be talking about the Adam Walsh Act. And then January 27th, again, a joint hearing with the Public Safety Finance Committee, and that will be during our time slot. All right. With that, this meeting is adjourned.